At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you. Most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.
You walk into this room at your own risk, because it leads to the future. Not a future that will be, but one that might be. This is not a new world. It is simply an extension of what began in the old one. It has patterned itself after every dictator who has ever planted the ripping imprint of a boot on the pages of history since the beginning of time. It has refinements, technological advances, and a more sophisticated approach to the destruction of human freedom. But like every one of the superstates that preceded it, it has one iron rule. Logic is an enemy and truth is a menace. The Chancellor, the late Chancellor, was only partly correct. He was obsolete. But so is the state, the entity he worshipped. Any state, any entity, any ideology that fails to recognize the worth, the dignity, the rights of man, that state is obsolete. A case to be filed under M for Mankind.
No logic, no reason, no explanation. Just a prolonged nightmare in which fear, loneliness, and the unexplainable walk hand in hand through the shadows. In a moment, we'll start collecting clues as to the whys, the whats, and the wheres. We will not end the nightmare, we'll only explain it. Because this is the Twilight Zone.
Happy heresies, and welcome to the Desert of the Real. Welcome, everybody, to AM Byte, and Happy New Year. Happy 2025. Here we are in January on a Mars day. My name is Miguel Connor, and I am your host and pompous of Gnosis, and I am very excited for today's show. In fact, I already see in the chat, people are doing their best Rod Serling impersonations on the YouTube chat because it's automatic. My favorite one, which I've used in the show, is "We will not end the nightmare. We will only explain the nightmare." So we all have it. But with us, very excited about this show. Long overdue, a very Gnostic, surreal, mystic theme show. And that is the Twilight Zone. And with us to take us on this journey, on this surreal journey, it is a pleasure to have Arlen Schumer, who will be discussing his new book, The Five Themes of the Twilight Zone. Arlen, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Hey, thank you for having me, Miguel. I'm so excited to talk about the Twilight Zone and everything your show's about and how they intertwine.
Yeah, and this show, as we're going to find out, is very relevant, and you've mentioned it in your book and many of your presentations you're giving. It's in this age of social media and post-truth and all that, it's probably more relevant than ever. And
absolutely.
It took us here.
Yeah, I mean, I did a webinar a couple of years ago when the pandemic hit called Twilight Zone in the Age of Corona, and how so many of the episodes are about isolation, about separation from reality, abandoned cities, all the sheltering in place, all the things we were going through that these Twilight Zone episodes evoked. And that's because Rod Serling was a visionary, a true visionary who, you know, was not only of his time, but timeless, which is the definition of art itself.
Oh, indeed. A genius. Somebody I put up there. We've been on email. I put him on the same label as Jack Kirby, Philip K. Dick, William Burroughs. Somebody who saw the reality behind reality and prophesied what our age is going to be, our, you know, internet nuclear age.
Exactly. I mean, even the word paranormal, which means, you know, above and beyond reality. Well, that's what the Twilight Zone was, which is what surrealism was. You know, the word surreal, it's French. It means on top of reality. The original surrealists in the early 1929, they wanted people to step back from their reality and look at it fresh. If they could look in a crystal ball and see into the future and saw the Twilight Zone, Rod Serling, they would have accepted him as a true surrealist, except he put it on television. It was surreal. You know, people describe The Twilight Zone, oh, it was a science fiction show. Well, yeah, the bulk of the episodes were, and Serling employed some of the greatest science fiction writers of the 20th century, Richard Matheson, Charles Beaumont, George Clayton Johnson, among others. But the thing is that it was also, people say, oh, well, it was a horror show. Yeah, there were some of those shock endings that were truly horror invoking. Or some people say it was a fantasy show. Well, it was grounded in a reality far more real and true for both its day and ours. The Twilight Zone, above all those things, was surreal. It was surrealism on television. All of those episodes are about, you know, when you hum the Twilight Zone theme music, when something weird happens in your life, you're invoking a surrealist experience. You've stepped back from your reality, paranormal, and looked at it fresh. And that's what the greatest Twilight Zone episodes do, is that the characters go through that. And by extension, ourselves as the audience watching the show, we become those characters. And that's why we can relate the Twilight Zone to our own lives, because we've all had those surrealist moments where we go, doo, 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 doo. That's what unites it all.
Well said indeed. And with us, we've got the Moondog Vince. Vince, how are you doing?
Oh, I got cold hands and warm heart, just like Captain Kirk.
I was complimenting Vance on the great background of his, the concentric circles of the Twilight Zone, which, like so many of the graphics of the Twilight Zone, were both had antecedents in the surrealism graphics, but it was, they were also ahead of their time. Like that Twilight Zone vortex was ahead of op art, which emerged a couple of years later. And that's the great thing about the Twilight Zone graphics. So Vance, thumbs up.
Hey, my pleasure, sir.
What respect? What did I do to deserve such respect? Darling.
Well, yeah, for the audience, I see a good group today. I see the usual suspects, H.P. Lovecraft, Graham Pong, Black Eagle.
H.P. Lovecraft!
Yeah, he's here. You know, he's got a...
You know. Let me quote something. Stephen King, in a 1983 book he wrote, a nonfiction overview of the science fiction, fantasy, and horror fields called Dance Macabre. Do you know that book?
Yeah.
He devotes a chapter to the Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
And in it, he said, and I'm paraphrasing, Serling and the Twilight Zone lit the sparks of our imaginations. And the, like nobody since H.P. Lovecraft, Serling showed a new way. And in doing so, opened up a door of possibilities to him and his generation, the Steven Spielbergs, the George Lucases, the David Lynch's,
Jordan Peele, basically younger generation directors.
Yeah. Their descendants, meaning the creators of our modern fantasy, science fiction, and horror worlds, I can trace back to the Twilight Zone in less than 6 degrees of Rod Serling. And I'm punning on Kevin Bacon, if you know that, 6 degrees. But the thing is, Serling didn't invent science fiction. Serling didn't invent robots or people who think they're mannequins or any of those things. But he perfected them on the medium of television at a time when film television, especially anthology style, not continuing characters every week like every sitcom, but you know, even dramatic show, but anthology in only a half hour. In those 25 minutes, Serling and company were able to touch upon the deepest psychological, philosophical, paranormal concepts that philosophers and intellectuals have been debating for literally thousands of years. And through the medium of 20th century science fiction that Serling was a fan of, all those writers like Matheson and Beaumont, what he did was he brought serious science fiction to American television in a half hour form that he so perfected with those surprise endings. You know, Alfred Hitchcock had surprise endings, O. Henry wrote about surprise endings, but Serling perfected them for television. We still talk about those surprise endings like the pig faces, Eye of the Beholder. If you saw that when you were a kid, that burned its way into your brain forever.
Forever.
We don't talk about surprise endings they offered Hitchcock. I mean, maybe Hitchcock fans do, but my point is, Serling perfected these things for television. And in doing so, you know, there was never anything like The Twilight Zone before it, and there was never really been anything like it since. No more anthology drama, no more half-hour anthology drama. Everything shifted to 1 hour. But those half-hour episodes, if aliens beamed down right now in my apartment and said, Arlen, we have room on our spaceship for one Earth television show. What are you going to give them, guys? Are you going to give them The Sopranos? Are you going to give them Seinfeld? Are you going to give them, you know, I Love Lucy? No. I'm giving them The Twilight Zone, specifically the episodes in my book that I chose to write about, 68 out of 156. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, my feeling was, I'm very critical about the things I love. I'm a comic book historian. I'm an historian of Bruce Springsteen's music. But I'm as critical of those works as I am laudatory. As all fans, quote unquote, critics, historians should be. And in other fields, that's what they do. They create consensuses of what is best. I forgive over half of the Twilight Zone episodes, I think, are dogs. Now, there's various degree of dog, but I forgive those because churning out weekly half-hour anthology television where you didn't have the same sets or characters every week. You had to create a whole new world every week on a tight budget. So, yeah, they had a lot of duds, but you want to know something? I compare it to baseball, you know, percentages. 68 out of 156 is like batting .435. That ain't bad. No. You know, Serling wrote the bulk of the episodes, I think 92 or 3 out of 156. Out of the 68 episodes, 41, I think, are his. So 41 out of 92 is like batting 460 something. So that's how I grade The Twilight Zone. And, you know, these were episodes that I felt compelled to write about. And that's how I both judged it, by my emotional connection to them and my intellectual connection to them. What they said, what they spoke of, what they hinted at, what the plot was about, the performances of the actors. You know, every episode is like a little world. And I like to think that if you read these essays that I've written about them, and the way I've grouped them into the five themes, to say that even though Serling had other writers and directors and actors, it's kind of like Orson Welles with the Mercury Theater in a way. Serling was the auteur, just like Orson Welles was. And I broke it up into five themes: science and superstition, suburban nightmares, a question of identity, obsolete man, and the time. I forgot my own theme, the time element. Anyway, within each theme, those were, I think, Serling's broadest themes that all of the other writers, consciously or subconsciously, wrote to. So the 68 episodes are broken up into those five themes, and I've arranged each theme chronologically so that you get a sense of how that theme developed over the five-year run. But if I've done my job as the writer, even the most ardent aficionado of The Twilight Zone, and there are plenty out there, they might think they know these episodes just like I do. I've seen them 1,000 times. If I've done my job, maybe they're going to glean something. They might think about something. They might learn something. They might see that episode differently. And I'm counting on it because of the way I wrote these essays. They're almost like stream of consciousness reflections In other words, they're not just plot synopses. I mean, you can go on Wikipedia and get plot synopses, and every other book about the Twilight Zone, excuse me, has plot synopses. Sometimes if the essay calls for it, if the episode calls, I do relate my essay almost chronologically following the plot of the episode. Other times I'll reveal the so-called surprise ending right up front, because so many of these surprise endings have become pop culture lore. Burgess Meredith breaking his glasses at the end of Time Enough at Last. To Serve Man, it's a cookbook.
It's a cookbook.
These that have become, you know, part of our, again, the Twilight Zone influence is so pervasive that it's almost invisible. But again, through my essays, as the episode went on, if it suggested a relation to something in the wider popular culture, past, present, you know, fine art, commercial art, all the things that have influenced me growing up, you know, in the 60s and 70s and all the American pop culture I ingested, reflected back in these Twilight Zone episodes.
Yeah, it's a great read. Highly recommended, and I learned so much. But why don't we talk, before we get into the five themes, Arlen, we should probably discuss the man himself, Mr. Sterling. As again,
Sterling! Sterling! Oh, security! How dare you? Do you know how many people call him Sterling?
Yeah,
sometimes Sterling with Sterling.
Oh, God damn it. Okay, we'll edit that out later, Vance.
Yeah. Or maybe I'll be
I can't even go on. I gotta. Okay. And we're back.
Yes. I am in an
episode. That's all right. They screwed up Robbie the Robot in that one episode, so that makes up for what.
Listen, professional writers that have written about the Twilight Zone, articles I've seen online, sometimes they don't even catch it, and they call him Sterling. I'm saying it's. It's just a classic, you know.
It happens.
Yeah, but it is certainly.
Let's hope there's not. Yeah, somebody said there's not a Mandela effect with it. You never know. But
yeah, anyway. You know why? Sterling is so common, and Serling was so uncommon.
Yeah.
I mean, there's only been, you know, there's one Rod Serling. That was it.
That's it. But as we were emailing, he reminded me a little bit of Jack Kirby. Same. Working class Jewish fellow goes to World War II. Let me quote H.P. Lovecraft. Sees man-made horrors beyond imagination.
Like a whole generation coming out of
back, and something is open. Something is
Norman Mailer, J.D. Salinger. That whole generation either kept it inside, you know, like a whole, you know, so many of them did of the greatest generation, but others who were artistic leaning, cathartically channeled it through their writing, their artwork, whatever. But yeah, Sterling comes out of the World War II.
And of course, he comes to this world of nuclear warfare, mass media, shadowy empire. I mean,
and the new world of television. And the new medium of television at the same time.
Yeah, everything, the world had changed like never before.
And right.
Sterling is really able to tap into this.
Did you say Sterling again?
No, I said Sterling this time.
We'll check that, Vance.
Yeah.
Roll the videotape.
Yeah, we don't want to get Sterling now.
Yeah. I thought I heard Sterling.
But anyway, that's what made Sterling Sterling, right? That's it. Well, of course, he became very successful in TV anyway.
He was the right man at the right time. He transitioned from radio to television, you know, in the post-war era in the 1950s. He made his bones in live television coming out of New York City, where he won three Emmys in a row in 56, 7, and 8. And, you know, Requiem for a Heavyweight, things like that. Those three Emmys gave him the creative clout to go out to Los Angeles to do The Twilight Zone. Just as live television in New York died out because it was too expensive, not enough ratings, and television switched to filmed series on the West Coast. Just like the Dodgers and Giants moving out of New York in the late 50s, with the move to Los Angeles. So Sterling was thrust into this medium of film television, but he had come out of the live things that won him those Emmys that, you know, were socially conscious stories that he would later turn into Twilight Zone episodes. Themes like Obsolete Man. You know, his first Emmy was for Patterns, which is about the older executive being, you know, shoved aside for the younger, younger ad exec coming in. This whole post-war, you know, man in the gray flannel suit, you know, American businessman, that whole milieu, if you call it, Serling reflected from coming out of that era and writing about it and turning it into Twilight Zone episodes, like a stop at Willoughby, you know, about the ad man who can't take it anymore and fantasizes.
Willoughby.
Yeah. Willoughby. Next stop, Willoughby. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I mean, and also I think you mentioned in one, it was one of your talks, you talked about how he was still in Europe and his father passed away. He couldn't even go to the funeral. I mean, so he was pretty traumatized. Yeah.
Now, you know, for a Jewish son not to be able to bury his father is such a shanda, such a shame. But there was a lot of anti-Semitism in World War II that's not as discussed as it, you know, there was black, you know, segregation in World War II. But there was a lot of anti-Semitism. And I wouldn't be surprised if Serling was not allowed to go to his father's funeral because of anti-Semitism in, you know, the American hierarchy itself. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a whole other story for another time, right?
Yeah, but it was a dangerous time. Serling
reflected it all. You know, he couldn't say the word Jews in these Twilight Zone episodes, but he had one called He's Alive with Dennis Hopper as a neo-Nazi.
Yeah.
It's torn from today's headlines, but it's the great Dennis Hopper, you know, and, you know, he's talking about, oh, when they let foreigners in. Well, foreigners was, you know, code word for Jews in those
days. Could be the Irish.
Could have been the Irish. No, that was a generation before.
Oh, yeah, you're right. That was in the 20s.
But, no, but I'm just saying, you know, they were episodes about concentration camps in the Twilight Zone called Beth's Head Revisited. And even there, Serling couldn't have the word Jew in it. But, you know, you didn't need to be, you know, a linguist to read between the lines. So that's the way Serling got these timeless, socially conscious themes and ideas into half-hour television that influenced a whole generation. And especially, like I said, our generation of modern fantasy, science fiction, horror, you name it, are all Serling's metaphorical children. You know, he died 50 years ago this year. His centennial was actually last year. Mm. But Serling died in 75. If you think about 1975, Spielberg's Jaws came out that year. Stephen King's Carrie came out that year. Serling's metaphorical children were just coming to the fore when he died. He died, unfortunately, I think, thinking he didn't succeed. He didn't think the Twilight Zone was any big deal. He said, yeah, we had some turkeys. We had some episodes I'm proud to be a part of. But he didn't write the great American novel. He didn't write the great American stage play like one of his heroes, Arthur Miller. Serling only wanted to be remembered as a writer. And yet, when you see when he died in 75, if he had only lived 5 or 10 years longer, you know, he was only 50 years old and he died of smoking all those cigarettes. But if he had lived 5 or 10 years longer, he would have seen the full flower of his influence from the Twilight Zone on, you know, Spielberg, Lucas, everything that came has come since. And then he would have known how the Twilight Zone was so influential. And in a sense, you know, my father died when I was 4 months old. My mother raised my brother and I, my older brother, by herself. And I think I sought my father figures in the American pop culture I grew up with, the superheroes and the comic books I was reading. Serling himself was like a father figure, eventually, you know, Bruce Springsteen was a kind of father figure. I worked for my childhood idol, one of the great comic book artists of all time, named Neil Adams. he was like a father figure. I think in terms of what I've done for the Twilight Zone, in terms of my books, you know, my original book about the Twilight Zone, Coffee Table Art Book, came out in 1990 from Chronicle Books. And it's, you know, about, you know, treating the photography and the images like art photography. I can never find a good example. And the dialogue and narration like poetry. And that's how I always thought of the Twilight Zone, as this beautiful body of artwork. By the way, when you take off the dust jacket.
Oh, wow.
That's the first image I can recall seeing as a child. I must have been 4.5 years old in front of my black and white television set. So 32 years later, I end up doing a coffee table art book. So, gee, I became an artist. What a surprise, right? But yeah, so I think what I've done with, you know, my books, my lectures about the Twilight Zone, so much of which is right on my website on the Twilight Zone subpage, are almost like what I imagine the way a son would treat his father's works. I've honored Serling's work with what I've done, and I'm especially most proud of this, that I finally got down for posterity, treating these Twilight Zone episodes as the works of art that they are in book form. I've treated him as my metaphorical father in his honor, and keeping his works and indirectly my works alive through the Twilight Zone.
Yeah, keep that flame going, because it's so influential. I mean, I think one of your talks, you point out how it influenced even some of the great classics of our time, some of the Gnostic classics, like, let me read the list. Jacob's Ladder, one of my all-time favorite movies, is based on occurrence at Owl Creek Bridge. Yep. Truman Show, based off of A World of Different. Shadow Play influenced The Matrix, Vanilla Sky, and Inception. Let's see, and there's a few. Oh, The Lonely influence Westworld, another Gnostic show, and of course, most people know I Shot an Arrow to the Air is, you know,
most Planet people of don't the know. They don't know.
Oh, they don't know this. Oh, okay, most yes, it has the same ending, people, as the Planet of the Apes.
Most people do not. This is what I'm saying about the Twilight Zone's influence. It's so pervasive that it's almost invisible. Mm-hmm. And there are people, I'm telling you, if you pick 10 people off the street right now, I guarantee you, I'm going to say no more than 2 people might know that. And I think I'm being generous.
Yeah, but everybody knows the ending of Planet of the Apes. 8 people would know.
See, that's my point. People don't know that Serling wrote the co-wrote. You know, it's funny. I compare that ending, Planet of the Apes, and that's one of the greatest movie endings of all time, as great as Orson Welles' Rosebud. I mean, those are the two, like, Mount Rushmores of movie endings. Yes. And yet Serling took it from a Twilight Zone episode that he had done, you know, 30 years earlier. Oh, not 30, what am I saying? 8 years earlier. Yeah. But even that episode, and this is what people still don't know, unless you're a Twilight Zone aficionado, Serling got the idea for that episode at a cocktail party in Hollywood. It had to be sometime after the Twilight Zone debuted in the fall of 59. And they were talking about the new space program. You know, if you read the right stuff or saw the movie, you know, 1959 was the second year of the, you know, Mercury astronauts, right? So everybody was talking about the space race and Russia and the, right? And a woman named Madeline Champion says, you know, I bet you that if astronauts crash landed in the middle of the Mojave Desert, they would think they were on another planet. Serling took out his wallet and took out $500 and paid her right there on the spot for the idea and turned it into the 1960 episode in the spring, I think it aired, I Shot an Arrow into the Air. So that's the sort of chain of events. So technically, and she gets credit at the end of the episode based on an idea by Madeline Champion. So, but, you know, listen, that's how artists work. They take things from real life. You know, I think I think Ringo was in a cab and the driver was complaining about how hard he was working. And he goes, yeah, I'm working 8 days a week. So,
yeah, you know, the rest is history.
The rest is history, right? That, but it's true. True artists allow their reality to seep into their work. You know, I think it was Werner Herzog maybe who said, there's the movie you set out to make, and then there's the movie you end up making. Mm-hmm. And that's really true for any work of art, that you should allow, a real artist allows real life to seep in to the art, because that's the zeitgeist, the spirit mm-hmm. of the times. It's part of, but you see, true art is, again, both of its time and timeless. And that's the definition of art. That's why we always have to wait X number of years before we can really judge whether something is a timeless work of art.
Well said. What about you, Vince? Do you have a question, or do you have a favorite Twilight Zone episode, or one that you
really like? Let's see. It's hard to pick a favorite, but
you can. It's like picking your favorite kid, although maybe some parents. You know what I mean? It's like I might have a top five, but I got to tell you, you have to have at least a top 10. There's so many great episodes.
Oh, yeah.
Even you get to 10 and you go, oh, how can I leave this one out? And
how about the one with the Martians, Archie Bunker? They kept on screwing around with time. I don't remember the title of that, where, you know, the Martians in the hotel. They had this weird, they were hiding, they were watching people, and they're reeling them back and forth. Who's
I don't think you're describing a Twilight Zone episode.
I think that was, but
what are you talking about? Well, describe it again.
They're Martians were there. They were Martians, and they had some sort of little device, and they kept on aiming at people and wheeling them back and forth through time.
No, that's not a Twilight Zone episode.
I don't know what. Maybe it was an Outer Limits. But
can I tell you something? In all the years I've been lecturing in the Twilight Zone, people describe episodes that it turns out are not Twilight Zone, but that's because Twilight Zone became the kind of brand name for all the somewhat similar shows of that era, One Step Beyond, Outer Limits, whatever. There are some other vague shows that were around that had science fiction, fantasy elements. People describe episodes that are Alfred Hitchcock episodes thinking they're Twilight Zone. So that's what I find kind of amusing, that the first thing you thought of, Vance, if you were to name your favorite episode, it turns out wasn't even a Twilight Zone episode. So do you have a favorite Twilight Zone episode?
Well, I don't have a favorite, but I like the one where she went, you know, where all the people wind up to be ugly and she was beautiful. She's the only beautiful one.
Eye of the Beholder. Yeah. That used to be always number one in most Twilight Zone polls that I've seen over the years or decades. But in their intervening years, you know, To Serve Man usually ranks even higher, or
it always pops up last.
But you see, both of those, To Serve Man, while I admire the episode, I wrote about it in my book, it's what I call a punchline episode.
Yeah.
It's really a pun. I mean, it's a cute pun, but people remember that pun aspect of it. It's not in my top 25. I mean, it made my top 68 because I had something to say about it.
There's Lurch in it, you know.
And the other episode you mentioned, what was the other episode?
Well, before the show, I mentioned my favorites was The Hunt, Good Life, The Howling Man, because it's very, those are very.
The Howling Man by Charles Beaumont is all about the devil.
Yeah.
And it personifies the devil in the most classic way, with the horns and the pitchfork and the cape at the end of the episode.
Yeah, I love those.
And it's the most gothic of all the Twilight Zone episodes. It's got the castle and the lightning and the thunder and the tilted angles. Directed by the same director that did Eye of the Beholder, the pig face episode.
Yeah, and the one with Kirk at the diner. Everybody's got to love that. The little
devil head. The devil head.
And Nightmare at 20,000 Feet,
of course. Both
written by Richard Matheson.
Yeah. I love almost all the entire Star Trek original show cast appeared in Twilight Zone at one point.
Absolutely. You've got Nimoy, Kay, yep. is in a very little scene episode, very interesting in his own way. Serling was the first to have, listen, Roddenberry delivered the eulogy at Serling's funeral in 75 when he died. And again, to paraphrase the eulogy, he basically said Star Trek would have only been a glimmer in my eye if it hadn't been for what Serling did with the Twilight Zone and the doors that he opened. And, you know, Serling did diversity casting before the phrase obviously was coined, but Serling cast the first black man in a dramatic role in a 1960 episode, The Big Tall Wish. Mm-hmm. He cast women in serious dramatic roles as single independent women. You know, Serling had two daughters of his own, and that might have influenced that. But again, he treated women as individuals. One episode is about a woman artist living in New York City. I mean, you think in 1961 American television, there was a dramatic show about a female artist living in New York City. Yeah. You know, that's the same year Bob Dylan came to New York, by the way. So Serling is giving us a vision. So he's casting independent women, you know, black actors, more than just background characters that anybody else might have been doing. So Serling influenced that aspect of Star Trek. Matheson, George Clayton Johnson wrote the very first Trek episode. I think the very first great episode of Star Trek was Matheson's episode where Kirk splits into two, which was like the fifth episode.
Oh, yeah, like that one.
The Enemy Within, is that what it's
dog.
Called? Right?
Yeah. It's got a dog in it, a little horn. So the point
is, in the lectures I do about the Twilight Zone or the webinars where I show its influence on American television, films, modern art, popular culture, I go through these things and I show the influence of the Twilight Zone on both movies and on television shows that followed it. You know, beginning with Outer Limits, which again, when you said Vance, it might have been Outer Limits episode. Everybody recalls those fondly. But, you know, they were all 1 hour. I thought they were padded to fit the hour. You know, even when Twilight Zone for one season went to 1 hour, out of the 18 one-hour episodes, I think I write about three of them. Most of them are padded to fill the hour. But so were the Alfred Hitchcock episodes when they switched to an hour. There's something about that half-hour form for anthology television that just worked better than the one-hour form. If I could afford it, I would hire a professional television editor to take all those Outer Limits episodes, edit them down to a half hour. I guarantee you they'd be more watchable than they are now. But there's never been anything like the Twilight Zone ever since. I mean, they're
like... What about Chris Carter and the X-Files?
Okay, again, there are spinoffs of the Twilight Zone. The idea of extraterrestrial, whatever you would consider the X-Files, and they had a broad range of stories. But face it, Chris Carter is another one of Serling's metaphorical children.
Oh, yeah.
I think one of the episodes has Mulder talking about the episode that influenced him the most. He's talking about the Twilight Zone. And I think Carter wrote that episode, and it's basically Carter talking about how the Twilight Zone influenced him, which backs up what Stephen King said. And Dance Macabre, you know. So yeah, there are shows like The X-Files. The latest, the best sort of Twilight Zone influencee has been Charlie Brooker's Black Mirror coming out of England.
Of course.
Because it's technology run amok. So there's a general theme and all the episodes sort of fit into that theme, but they all come out of a single consciousness, which is his. He doesn't write all the episodes, but you know, they reflect his worldview. All the other knockoffs of the Twilight Zone didn't have that. That's why they all suck, in my opinion. The only thing, like I said, it's either do it well in your own sandbox, like Chris Carter did with the X-Files. And, you know, Vince Gilligan, who came out of the X-Files, and then he does Breaking Bad. And when Breaking Bad ended, I remember he was interviewed in TV Guide and they said, now that you've finished Breaking Bad and critics are calling it one of the greatest TV shows of all time, how do you want to be remembered? And he said, and again, I'm paraphrasing, if my show can be remembered in the future, the way we talk about the Twilight Zone today, you know, I'll be a happy boy. So that just shows you again the influence of the ongoing influence of the Twilight Zone.
Oh yeah, it is eternal. And Arlen, what would you say? How would you define the Twilight Zone? Or what? Where did Serlin read any esoteric books or treatise? I mean, what is the Twilight Zone? If somebody has to ask,
okay,
it. Not a show, but the concept.
Okay, so in 1924, the French poet André Breton created the movement of surrealism. It started out as a literary movement. They wanted people to write and drift off into a kind of a state of unconsciousness and do what they called automatic writing, or what we would call stream of consciousness writing. And so that's how surrealism started, as a literary movement. But because the poets hung out with the artists, it eventually became a visual movement with Salvador Dali, et cetera, et cetera. And it became, to this day, one of the most famous art movements, most popular. And last year was its 100th anniversary, its centennial of that first. Breton wrote a manifesto, and I'm going to try to quote it by word. Everything leads us to believe that there exists a spot in the mind where past and future, oh man, I got to quote it. It's right here in my book. I don't want to mess up the quote.
No problem.
I won't be able to find. Between past and future, high and low, the communicable and the incommunicable will cease to appear contradictory. What does Serling introduce the Twilight Zone with? There's a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is the dimension between science and superstition, between shadow and substance. And it lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone. So what Breton called the spot in the mind, where all these contradictory things coexist, a third reality on top of reality. You know, nothing is truly original. Anything original that laymen call original is really taking things that have never been pre-existing, things that have never been properly introduced. I call it the Reese's Peanut Butter School of Creation. Chocolate existed, peanut butter existed, but Reese brought them together, created Reese. But truly, surrealism said, in another one of Breton's manifestos, surrealism is like the unexpected meeting on a dissection table between an umbrella and a sewing machine. Now, whatever you might think that even means, what he was basically saying was, when you bring two things together that are two distinct realities, and when you bring them together, they create a third reality. 1 + 1 = 3. Right. You create a new reality. So that's not only the definition of surrealism, it's the definition of all creation, is taking pre-existing elements and bringing them together. The X factor is your individual soul that you inject into that chemical combination. So that's, to me, the definition of art. So that is why, that is the definition of the Twilight Zone. The dimension of imagination, just think about the possibility. It's sight, sound, and mind. It's involving all of the senses and injecting it into your inner self, your imagination. You know, again, physicists, theologians, we're still debating what is reality. Yeah. Now, the latest articles are saying reality only exists because we observe it. Or I'm taking things I see on, you know, Facebook or whatever, but it's also in the New York Times, right? Okay. My point is, we're still talking about the nature of reality or paranormal reality. And the Twilight Zone is basically showing us examples of those questions. Not necessarily giving the answers, but presenting the questions of what is reality. One of the episodes you mentioned, the Truman Show, the movie, Jim Carrey wakes up one day and, you know, his whole world is a manufactured fake world. Everything's fake. Everything's, you know, well, gee, haven't we all thought about that our own lives every now and then, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It is what philosophers have been debating. Do we live in a malevolent world or a benevolent one? Is there predestiny? If you believe in, you know, God has a plan for us and, you know, I know your past and I know your future, do we have free will then? Are we just acting out a script? So Richard Matheson, his greatest episode, in my opinion, 1960, A World of Difference, is about an actor who, no, it's not about an actor. It's about a businessman who goes to make a phone call in his office and the line is dead. And he gets up to go to his secretary outside to tell her about the problem. And he hears somebody yell, cut. And he turns and there's a whole movie crew there filming his life. Okay. So that's Richard Matheson's concept, right? He's a businessman who's all of a sudden his life has become a movie.
Oh my God, yeah.
With a movie crew, he's an actor, an alcoholic actor, who's gone off his nut and believes he's the role he's playing in the movie they're filming about a businessman. So again, in 25 minutes, Matheson and by extension Serling are presenting this philosophical, deeply meaningful paradox about life itself. If you really think about it, what is the real reality? Are we living, again, do we have predestiny? Are we acting on a script? Do we have free will? Are we playing a role? What is our authentic self? I mean, the list
of Plato's cave, are we in the Matrix?
My point is, as teaching tools, again, while not sacrificing any dramatic narrative, what's great about these episodes, if you're teaching storytelling to, let's say, young directors in film school, these are primers on terse, pungent, tight storytelling. The best episodes suck you in the first 30 seconds to a situation. A woman is at a bus station and she sees herself in the mirror, you know, in the bus station. That happens in the first 5 minutes. And I mean, it sucks you into this nightmare world all of a sudden. Where are there duplicates? Haven't we all thought we saw somebody that looked just like us? And I mean, this is something, again, science fiction writers wrote about in those pulp novels that only science fiction fans read. You know, the reason why the 50s had all those giant monster movies or science fiction movies with giant ants and stuff was because they weren't adapting, by and large, the great science fiction short stories, because science fiction literature was considered junk. And it was only read by a small, you know, coterie of fans.
Same with comic books.
All from Southern California. My point is, Serling took those great stories and treated them seriously and adapted them for television. You know, the art of adaptation, Serling was a master of. Some of the greatest episodes are not Serling originals. They're adaptations. Time Enough at Last. Why do people remember that episode? Because of the cruelty of the ending. We had come as an audience to sympathize with Burgess Meredith's character. He was likable. He had that horrible wife that ripped up his poetry book. We fell in love with Henry Bemis, and then he finally got redemption. He had time enough at last to read all his library books. And then he breaks his glasses. Now, if you know anything about Serling, though he had seen the horrors of death, he had a positive worldview. But you see, this was an adaptation of a woman named Lynn Venable. And that was her ending. And the thing is, that's a very negative ending. That's a very pessimistic ending. The idea that a likable character, and you know, it almost violates the unspoken rules of storyteller and audience. How dare you make us fall in love with a character and then play a merciless trick on him? And yet, that's why the episode is remembered, for the cruelty of the ending. I believe had it been a Serling original, it would have ended with a crane shot pull away of Bemis reading his books. with the, you know, fade out to black at the end.
But you know, he could have gone to an optometrist's office and gotten one of those, you know, variable things that they had.
Yeah, how everybody would fix Time Enough at Last. But all I'm saying is the two episodes more remembered than Eye of the Beholder is you know, a pun episode, To Serve Man, and a cruel episode that was a Serling adaptation. And by the way, so was To Serve Man. That was an adaptation of a story by Damon Knight from 1950. So again, some of the fondest remembered Twilight Zone episodes are, I think out of the 41 of the 68 episodes in my book that are written by Serling, a dozen of them are adaptations. And those dozen, again, are some of the most popular Twilight Zone episodes. This is why they give Oscars to best adapted screenplay, because adapting is an art form in itself. And Serling was an underrated master of adapting short stories into Twilight Zone episodes.
And of course, like you said, To Serve Man has been adapted in other stories like V. We've had two iterations of V, famous classic science.
Again, this is where you get the 6 degrees of Serling. It all comes back to the Twilight Zone. Again, in my lectures, I touch upon all of these. Like I said, the list goes on and on, but I pick the best sort of influences. You know, I've got a whole film program design called the Twilight Zone episodes and the movies they inspired. And it's that whole list, you know, that I show the influence. I'm having a screening in New York City on January 30th, where I team Serling's favorite episode, A Stop at Willoughby, with the cult classic movie, The Swimmer, from 1968, starring Burt Reynolds, in a role he considered his greatest, by the way. Have you ever seen The Swimmer, either of you?
Long time ago.
Do you remember?
A little bit.
Okay, you didn't see it. I don't buy that you saw it and you don't remember it. The Swimmer is so memorable. It's one of the greatest films of the 60s. It's become a cult classic. But why am I pairing it with A Stop at Willoughby? A Stop at Willoughby was about a harried ad exec who can't take it anymore, jumps off the train and kills himself. But in his dreams, he's off in Willoughby, this idyllic 19th century town that represents his escape from the rat race. Well, The Swimmer is about an ex-ad man who decides one day, he's middle-aged, he's going to swim across the county via his neighbor's swimming pools. Now, it's based on a 1964 John Cheever short story. Cheever, famous for writing about the dark underbelly of suburbia. Again, that's part of what was the Twilight Zone. David Lynch with Blue Velvet, the dark underbelly of suburbia. Serling was doing that on the Twilight Zone with A Stop at Willoughby. And The Swimmer, as you follow this, if that story isn't already surreal enough, the idea of swimming across swimming pools, the way they create a movie out of that, like all the great cult films, it was a flop in its day. It had some interesting reviews, but like all great cult films and all great works of art, they're sometimes not welcomed or are a success when they come out. Many of our greatest works of art became great works of art many, many years, decades, hundreds of years later. You know, Moby Dick, I think Malcolm Gladwell writes about this in Outliers. Moby Dick is considered the great American novel. Well, Herman Melville, who wrote it, he died unknown, a pauper. His books were forgotten. I think he died in 1850 or something like that. Or no, he died later, but he did Moby Dick, and then he did a book called Omu, I think, and that was it. And then he died, and he was forgotten for decades until 1925. A student at Yale in their literary society is going through his grandmother's attic and discovers this dusty copy of a novel called Moby Dick. He had never heard of it, right? He was a literary club member. He reads it. He loves it. He shares it with his book club. It's Yale. So within a generation, Moby Dick becomes the great American novel. And that's sometimes how works of art are. But
the movie It's a Wonderful Life was not a hit. It got forgotten.
Yeah. By the way, it had a second life on television.
Yeah, once the license died.
I remember seeing it as a kid on television, just like I saw The Swimmer on television when I was a teenager, late one night on one of the local New York stations. But that's, again, how art operates sometimes. So I connect Willoughby with the story of The Swimmer and what's revealed about him as we go on this journey with him. And by the time we get to the ending of The Swimmer, when we talked about great movie endings, Rosebud and, you know, Planet of the Apes, the ending of The Swimmer, I believe, is another of the great movie endings of 1968. And you've got to see it to believe it. So when you, in my screening in New York City, I'll be introducing first A Stop at Willoughby, and then in between Willoughby and The Swimmer, I'll explain the connection between the two. So when you watch The Swimmer, I'm basically positing that The Swimmer is what would have happened to the character from Willoughby had he not jumped off the train and killed himself. Had he gone home to a wife who had deserted him, to the loss of his job, his income, to the loss, you know, of his livelihood, he probably might have cracked up and wound up in a mental institution. And maybe he escapes in his swim trunks, which is how the movie and the short story, The Swimmer, begins, where he comes out of the woods in his swim trunks and begins swimming across his neighbor's pools. So that is the way I connect the two. And of course, after the screening, I'll be signing copies of my book. It's a beautiful little cabaret-sized theater on the Upper West Side in New York City. So it's a Thursday night, January 30th. And I hope everybody in the New York area can come to that.
Good deal. And you have information on your website, arlenschumer.com?
Yeah, there's an events blog page that you click on with all of my events. And I always have, you know, all the descriptions and the URL links that you'll need.
Well, check it out. Should be a good one for sure. Well, you want to look at some of your visuals? Let's see. Let's show the audience here at the stage. Here is your book, The Five Things of the Twilight Zone.
I'm very proud of my graphic design. I love that cover.
Yeah, it's a great cover. Very loyal, too. But here you have, of course, here's your table of contents.
So in a sense, the five themes are like the five chapters of the book. And I repeat the television motif just on the five chapter pages with a little description, of why this theme. And then I list all the episodes that I believe are reflections of that theme.
He took from Forbidden Planet in several ways. That's the Forbidden Planet ship there.
So the Twilight Zone was shot on the MGM stage, and MGM did Forbidden Planet in 1956. So the Twilight Zone production people were able to get access to things like the spaceship, which they used in multiple episodes of the show, and various costumes and props. Oh, yeah. All came out of Forbidden Planet. Yeah.
And Robbie, which I mentioned before, they screwed up. Tin can in his head.
In the Uncle Simon episode. But you see,
oh yeah,
the Twilight Zone, again, was about the dimension of imagination. You know, whenever the Twilight Zone did monsters like the Outer Limits would do and things like that, they came off cheap looking and hokey. You know, the great Nightmare at 20,000 Feet with William Shatner. You know, Richard Matheson hated the furry gremlin on the wing.
It was pretty hokey.
That when he bent down, you could see the soles of his plastic feet. And that's why he remade the episode with Spielberg, you know, in 1983 with John Lithgow, you know, with a better gremlin. But, you know, people still love that gremlin, but Matheson hated it. The other Matheson episode called The Invaders with Agnes Moorehead, with the little, all the little Michelin men, puffy suited little, you know, troll characters. And they turn out to be Earthmen, of course. Spoiler alert, right?
Right.
But, you know, Matheson hated those as well. And that's why he remade that episode as one of the Trilogy of Terror TV movies with Karen Black in 1972 with a Zuni hunting fetish. You know that episode?
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's Matheson rewriting The Invaders because he hated the little. So my point is the best episodes worked in your imagination, not in a physical manifestation. You know, the greatest time travel episode, Walking Distance, is about a man, another one of Serling's doppelgangers, you know, another harried ad exec who can't take the rat race anymore. And he walks back into his hometown 25 years earlier. There's no special effects. The screen doesn't go, woo. No, he literally walks back in time. But the way the director films it creatively, he shoots it in a mirror in a gas station cigarette machine. So as the character walks away, we see his reflection in the mirror walking away, and the director zooms his camera into the mirror. That's called creative filmmaking. It's not cheap special effects. And by and large, the greatest Twilight Zone episodes did that. It worked on your imagination. The Outer Limits was the monster of the week. I mean, they're laughable. I don't know how you can take some of those episodes seriously. But, you know, everything has its fans. But I maintain The Outer Limits was influenced by The Twilight Zone. It had some okay episodes. But, again, they were all padded, in my opinion. Okay, Nightmares. Again, I talk about...
Hey, shining crazy diamonds. Please subscribe for the second part of this interview. It certainly helps grow this Red Pill cafeteria. What's more, beyond getting the second half, you get content earlier and don't have to worry about flapdoodle commercials here or on other public platforms. So please become a Red Circle sub, Patreon, or AB Prime member for the full consciousness expanding gnosis. At Patreon, I have tiers as low as $1 or $3 a month. And at Red Circle, it's a clean $4.99 a month to stream all full shows. All subs include a dedicated private stream that works on most apps. Don't forget the Gnostic Tarot, which is selling well and optimizing spiritual growth based on the feedback I've gotten, and the Virtual Alexandria Academy. I can't do it without you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.
It's 2 a.m. Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.